The eight, Oregon State Police Technology Budget Issues. Larry, you want to explain to us what we are looking at?
Yes, Chair Hill and Senator Duncan, we are here today to have an overview from the state police on their IS budget. I handed out to you and the committee members a briefing document that talks to you a little bit about their budget. They had, in the 99 session, they had four budget notes that are also outlined in there. In their information systems budget, there are several technology-related packages, and I've given you some information on the funding sources for those, and there are some equipment purchases that are planned. One particular policy package they'll discuss in greater detail today relates to the public safety data warehouse. Of the four budget notes, one of those related to the 911 emergency response system, one related to information technology strategy, the other to criminal justice information system, and the other to LEDS transaction charges. The interim studies related to both 911 and the LEDS transaction fee, and they'll talk about that a little bit. And they had one appearance in the interim to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management Technology, and it was on the Public Safety Data Warehouse Project. I have attached in the packet for you the write-up that was presented to that committee, and they'll give you an update on that project while they're here. And they're here to address the questions that the committee provided to them.
Excellent. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Zane, and I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Oregon State Police. With me today at the table is Major Dan Biscard, our Budget Director, and immediately to my right is Dave Yandell. He is our LEDS be available to answer questions specific to Public Safety Data Warehouse, LEDS Message Switch, NCIC 2000. We've provided a handout today that hopefully tracks pretty close to the questions that we got 13 questions from the Legislative Fiscal Office that we knew that you wanted to talk about. We've got considerably more material based on other questions that we've heard you asking other agencies that have come before you, and we can provide those handouts as time and interest permits. And I guess I'd like to begin by addressing together questions 1 and 3, where you asked us to talk about our policy option packages for the coming biennium and our base budget IT initiatives for the coming biennium. And what we've done is we have attached in the very back of your, not the very back of your document, the first attachment, that's about halfway through your packet, is a list of those projects, both policy option and base budget IT projects for the coming biennium. I want to make sure you're on the page with me before I get started, because I'm going to kind of walk through the information contained in it. You should be looking, following the page that says attachment, you should be looking for a page that looks something like this, about halfway through your packet.
After attachment.
What time? How are you?
Right after attachment.
I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, probably. Oh, okay.
This is the one primary IT policy option package that we have for the 01-03 biennium that's been approved by the governor's recommended budget. It deals with the public safety data warehouse. To walk you through that, I guess I'd like to turn to Dave Yandell, our LEDS director, to kind of give you the specifics on what we hope to accomplish with the funding in the coming biennium for this project.
Chair Hill, members of the committee, for the record, I am David Yandell, director of the Law Enforcement Data System Division. Concerning the Public Safety Data Warehouse, this initiative results from legislation passed during the 1997 session. This was House Bill 2229, which was a corrections bill, in which was contained a requirement that there be a means established to develop the effectiveness of adult and juvenile corrections programs to determine which programs were effective at reducing future criminal behavior. During the interim, during 1998, there was a governor's working group established, made up of all the criminal justice practitioners that have a role to play in answering that question. The result of their work was a final report submitted to the governor in December of 98, which contained a recommendation that there be created a public safety data warehouse in which data from the Oregon Judicial Department, the Department of Corrections and the State Police would be entered specifically to allow for answering that specific question. Since that time, with the initiative to proceed with that project, we've added the Oregon Youth Authority. A number of tasks have been completed over the course of the last 12 to 18 months, including the hiring of a full-time program executive for the warehouse. Nell Klumpf is her name. You may recall that she was here before the interim committee in November when we gave our initial report in response to the budget note from last session. We are preparing for this next biennium to complete what we are referring to as Phase 1A and 1B of Phase 1, anticipating that we will have the scoping aspect of the project completed by December of this year and actually begin the formal construction work between January the 1st of 2002 and intending to complete Phase 1 of the project by June of 2003 or within this next biennium. The work that we are currently doing is primarily to set the stage for convening a stakeholders meeting, which will be is currently scheduled for March the 9th of this year, in which all of the stakeholders that I mentioned previously, specifically Judicial, Department of Corrections, State Police, and the Oregon Youth Authority, and the Department of Administrative Services will all meet to specifically lay the foundation for the work that will take place between now and the end of this year.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Yarnell, but I must ask a question. You're aware, are you not, that the governor's proposed budget cuts $39 million from the OIA and correction budget? I'm wondering how that impacts our goals in this regard, or
sure.
If it will.
Chair Hill, Representative Lowe, we certainly are aware that there are budgetary constraints that all state agencies will be facing this next biennium. One of our priorities with Phase 1 of the project is to speak to the continuation of funding beyond Phase 1, recognizing that the plan that we are working against calls for actually four phases in the project, Phase 2 being the addition of any other state agencies that are identified and local government. Phase 3 being a courts module, and Phase 4 being an actual analytical program to actually develop the statistical analysis. We feel it's very important to the longevity of the project that we try to answer the very question that you raised very early on. I anticipate spending a lot of time on that process between now and the end of this year, specifically to identify what is our plan for continuing funding for the project and what's the most cost-effective means of ensuring its survivability.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Are you happy to answer any questions that you have?
Just the only thing else I would note on that question is that the policy package that's presented before you is showing just the funding within the Department of State Police, which is all other funded loan grant. There's some small general fund component.
Thank you, Mr.
Nice
Counselor. But my concern is that if we cut the funding out from under the other agencies that have a duty to respond and participate in this, then we don't want to lose sight of our target, which is to enhance our ability to track criminals through the process and to be more effective in the use of our resources.
With the chair's indulgence, I would like to share with you, I guess, a little bit of the scope and the magnitude of this issue beyond just the public safety data warehouse, if that's all right, sir.
So you're going to start tracking younger offenders that fit in the attorney's program, or not just old offenders?
Mr. Chair, we would hope so.
Yes.
Okay. There are currently two local government systems that are in development that we see playing a very integral role in this initiative on a statewide basis. Both Multnomah County and Lane County have warehouse initiatives that they are currently working on. We've had very close dialogue with both of them over the course of the last year. As recent as last week, I met with the Lane Council of Governments with their risk assessment program and shared with them the concerns that we have that we need to make sure that the initiative that we are about to undertake is truly an integrated approach with all of our criminal justice partners on a statewide basis, and that we seek a use for this technology beyond just what 2229 addressed. So So our directive to our program executive has been specifically to focus on the short-term requirements of fulfilling phase one of the project, but looking beyond to how do we propose to use this technology to benefit the policymakers for the future. So we're very excited about this project and feel that it has a lot of potential that we've not yet been able to scratch, and that we are certainly wanting to work with our local government partners to help develop that on a statewide basis.
Let me follow up in terms of the comment you just made. In terms of, is the notion of doing this is to get policy data? In terms of, I mean, is that the impetus for doing this, or is the impetus to create a single system in which all the, as you're doing, the practitioners, I like that term, of the criminal justice system could participate and have a single point so that we reduce the, I see this as reducing the overall cost of the criminal justice and judicial system by having a single element in where everybody is inputting, data is only input once in the process. The side benefit of that is the fact that then as policymakers, we can start looking at metrics and start looking at other issues that we wouldn't necessarily have the data readily available to us that can help us make policy decisions, which could then further reduce. So I'm just trying, where are we driving? What's the goal? Is it to the greater efficiencies, or right now is it policy driven?
Chair Hill, the immediate focus is to fulfill the directives under 2229. And that specific directive was to bring together data from these initial four stakeholders to allow us to measure the effectiveness of existing adult and juvenile corrections programs to determine which programs are effective at reducing future criminal behavior. That is our primary goal. But what we are realizing from talking to those that have worked with this technology is if you don't develop the business case for how you propose to use repository for the future, you run the risk that once you're done, if you've only got one thing you can do with it, that the stakeholders lose interest in the project, the executive sponsors begin to question what the value is, and what we're trying to do is at the front end of the project begin the thinking process of identifying what other means can we use this technology for to benefit state government and the policymakers in making the best decisions possible.
So from that perspective, do you see a need to change policy decisions that were the original impetus of this, so that's the benefit as a result from the effort in terms of, you know, being able to look at the effectiveness of those specific programs, but in terms of, I see a fiscal effectiveness in terms of overall getting a criminal justice information system which is consistent across all the states, where everyone is inputting the data, is going to increase and benefit everyone at all levels. So, I'm just curious in terms of, is the mission so narrow that we need to come back and relook at the mission to broaden it out so that we're looking at it from the right perspective, saying that if you can't convince the people to participate to give you the data, you're never going to get the data to collect it, whether they're effective or not. It's going to cost you far more because no one's going to want to participate. It'll be sort of an afterthought, and it'll be one of those statutes that we just ignore going forward, versus something which could be the basis of a truly cost-effective revamp of the justice system and bringing some of the effectiveness that I know Representative Lowe and Representative Patridge have commented to me in terms of needs to be there to help that system.
Chair Hill, to be perfectly honest with you, I don't think that we're far enough along with the development of the project to answer that question, but we have discussed the very issue that you raise, and I would anticipate that we will, at some point in the future, assuming this project proceeds, that we will be before you to answer some of those very questions.
If I might, I think, we're trying to make sure that we don't allow the scope to increase too much beyond our means.
No, I understand
that. We want to limit the scope, yet at the same time, when we see what's going on around us and some of the other systems that are being developed, we want to design and engineer this in such a way so as to take advantage that if additional funding does become available for phases 2, 3, and 4, we have engineered it at the front end to be able to move forward, take advantage of some of the other things that are going on right now in the state, I think is maybe the best way to put it.
Thank you, Chair Hill. I appreciate what the department's done. I worked on their budget last time and was intimately involved in some of the budget notes that occurred during the last session. And I know that under this policy package, responding to maybe the budget note regarding the information technology strategy or the budget note that's labeled, by the same token, and I'm sorry I missed the front end of what happened here, I think part of what Representative Hill is talking about and the thing that most concerns me long-term is it's great to have the data warehouse and track offenders and do some of those things, but how has the agency responded to the budget note that reads CGIS, Enterprise Technology Plan? The subcommittee expects the department to convene a work group of the CGIS agencies and develop a criminal justice enterprise technology plan. The plan should be consistent with the statewide enterprise information technology strategy and address priorities for the state criminal justice information systems community. And how, you know, I think the two kind of dovetail with each other to some degree. I mean, you obviously had a mandate because of the data warehouse, but I'm more concerned about the global question that gets raised. And, you know, I have some concern, and I'll ask some questions about the lead system later and how that's tracking and what's gone on with that. But my concern is, you know, the data is not getting entered in a timely manner, that we may be issuing concealed weapons permits or doing other things and not being able to prosecute as a result of the fact that your data is not being entered in a timely manner, and that not being just state police's problem, but CGIS is under the auspices of the state police. That's why we put the budget note in your budget. So I'd like you to respond to that question as best you can.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, I'm the chair of the CGIS Advisory Board, and we have been meeting over the course of the past year to fulfill the requirements of the budget note to develop a technology plan that's consistent with the state's enterprise information technology plan. DAS has participated in that with us. We've worked with our stakeholders, I think, pretty close to try to have a document that we think is realistic as far as what it is we can do with funding constraints everybody's faced with. So we've had a series of meetings. We've gotten a draft. I call it a final draft of the CGIS Enterprise Technology Plan. We'd be happy to provide that to you. And even, I mean, I've got some slides here, not slides, but I've got a handout today that kind of walks you through, you know, what the fundamentals of that plan are, what the specific projects is that we're looking at. And if you'd want to take time either today or I understand we may be coming back on Monday, I'd be happy to do it then as well.
Great. Well, I will tell you from my side of the table, I frankly am not willing to support any criminal justice money at all for technology until we have a plan in place and know where we're going, because we're spending money willy-nilly across the board, whether it be money that's going through to the counties on their 911 systems, you know, that are operated by sheriffs or local police agencies, or whether it be the courts or whatever's happening. And I don't feel like we have a strategy. That's why I asked for the budget note last time. I was pretty serious and very frank and upfront about it. So I don't feel like my position is unreasonable based upon where I said I was going to come down. But we asked for a finalized plan. The plan needs to be in place, and we need to have that. And if we weren't clear enough, that concerns me, I guess. But I don't want to spend more money if we don't have some standards and some open architecture, so that we're not doing duplicate entry at every level of the state corrections system. And just to share for the committee, I mean, part of my concern is, and maybe to walk the committee through it to understand where I'm coming from as we ask these questions, are, you know, if we have a law enforcement encounter with someone, first it goes into the 911 system for the most part, then it goes from either a local police agency, sheriff, or state police into possibly the judicial system, because for the courts, it will go to a DA's office, typically, and a lot of times it'll go to a local county jail. Then from there, the information needs to go out to those three entities on a continual basis until the case is fairly resolved. Then ultimately, it needs to go into LEDS all during that process. It also needs to, once a case is finished, it needs to go, you know, to Department of Corrections, to the various parole and probation departments. or community corrections, or whatever you want to call them, around the state. There's data entry now. None of those systems really, for the most part, talk to each other at this point in time. And that's of substantial concern to me. That's why we asked for the budget note last time. And I guess I'm disappointed that you guys are coming without a plan this time.
As I mentioned, Representative Patridge, we do have a plan. I don't know when would be the best time to walk this committee or you or others through that. We could take the time right now to do that, if that would be the pleasure of this committee to focus on what we've done as far as the CGIS community. I've got a separate handout for that. I didn't bring copies of the plan, but I'm happy to provide that to you prior to the next time we meet with you.
Well, I know that there's people here that are testifying. I know people from have come up from Medford and other places to testify as well, I think, regarding things and regarding 911 and other issues. But, maybe it's not the appropriate time right now, based on the fact that it's 4 o'clock, and I think we should respect those people who've traveled the distance that we've been.
And to speak to that, the agency will be back again on Monday, so perhaps they could brief you between now and then and then focus some of their time on Monday.
We'd be happy to do that.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, assumption.
Not yet.
You want to give us, let's jump into 911, and we'll take, so give us an overview of what we're talking about. Okay.
The 911 program.
Yeah, and then we'll take the public testimony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mr. Chair. Related to your questions about our 911 program and what the plans are for that, we've asked Ken Keim with our Office of Emergency Management. He oversees the 911 program for the state. We've asked him to come and prepare, give you an overview, and be available to answer any questions that you might have related to the plans for the 911 program and the technology that we're using and planning to use.
Before you start, there's a sign-up sheet over on the table now. So if you need to testify, you can go sign up. And then we'll call you up.
All right, Chairman Hill, members of the committee, my name is Ken Keim, Section Director, 911 Program Manager for the Office of Emergency Management, Oregon State Police. The 911 program is moving forward with the completion of wireless technology for location. Currently, the wireless industry is working towards, along under FCC mandates, to be able to provide location technology when our wireless phone is used to dial 911. Currently today, under wireless phase one of the FCC rules, the local tower that accepts that call assigns a fake telephone number to that call to route it through the network to get it to the proper PSAP responsible, PSAP being the primary public safety answering point, responsible for the emergency services for that area where the tower is located. The call reaches the PSAP, and a callback number is associated with that call. So currently today, we can call you back if you dislocate, drop the phone, something like that. The next phase is phase two, which is mandated by the FCC, and currently we are working to provide that to the 56 primary public safety agencies in Oregon, and that would allow us to actually route that call based on a latitude and longitude associated with where you're calling from through the network to the proper PSAP. At the proper PSAP, display a map of your location from where you're calling on that map to route emergency responders to your location. And right now we're proposing to do a trial in the next couple months to validate that technology, but mostly to let us know what it's going to take to convert data at a local PSAP that's now in a tabular form under what's called a MAP, MSAG, under GIS, and by converting that data, we'll be able to interpret the lat and long and also the nearest address to as a reference point to get emergency services to the proper location. We estimate that the files will cost about $69,000.
So do you have any handouts on this?
I have some very basic handouts on what 911 is. Can I get those for you?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Currently, like we were trying to do the trial, once the trial is done and we're able to get our arms around what kind of costs we're going to be able to have, basically with the database conversion from, like say, a flat tabular file into a GIS mapped MSAG, we'll be able to start implementation around the state. Now, we're also dealing with the wireless companies choosing what kind of technology they want to use to provide the lat and long, et cetera. Right now, under this system, we're just looking at what's coming down the technology pipe to the PSAP, the data pipe, basically the lat and long. We're going to have to read it, whether it's collected via what they call a handheld telephone, which is your current cell phone that's equipped to take lat and long and transmit that along with your call, or with what they call the current cell phone with a network solution where the towers around you are reading your location, pinpointing that, and also sending that down the line with your call. We'll be able to do that either way. There are some issues with the cost to the local wireless companies as to what kind of technology they're going to use.
I've been reading up on this, trying to understand a little bit more about this issue, and there's a cost recovery requirement the FCC has for wireless companies. And we looked at the stream of dollars coming in from the wireless users and the 75-cent excise tax, and the specific technology paths in terms of how we finance this, because there was some discussion that I had in terms of it was like almost $25,000 per cell tower. Right. And I'm just curious in terms of, do we have enough revenue stream over time? If we look in terms of the stream of revenue that's coming in, how long will it take us to actually implement this across the state in full phase two, if we go that technology versus everybody requiring it to get a new handheld device that has the GPS capabilities in it?
Chairman Hill, we have looked at that, and the FCC has come out with a ruling basically on phase two will not be passed, the cost for that technology will not be passed on to the PSAPs, which would allow us to go ahead and whatever technology was chosen by the carrier, they could go ahead and implement what we'd be able to read. If we had to pay that cost, be it, we've had estimates between $20,000 and $30,000 per site, in Washington County alone, that'd be $90 million. You estimate 300 sites up there, it's pretty, not 9 million dollars, that would be pretty expensive. And so when they dropped that requirement, the process has moved forward. Now they're having issues with people asking for waivers, et cetera, and exactly how this is going to go. The reasoning behind that was that when these cell companies deploy the services, they're going to have the ability to sell what they call concierge services, such as restaurant locations, nearest hotel, nearest gas station, those kinds of issues, and people subscribe to that, and that will help them recover their costs. Right now, we're moving forward based on that issue. We've been talking to the cell phone companies in Oregon, whether who's going to charge, who doesn't want to charge, and see where that goes. Right now, we do pay a charge for cellular phase one service of approximately 16 cents per subscriber per month to the wireless companies to provide that information on phase one, the routing, technology and the network that they have to expend on their side to route those calls correctly. And that would probably remain the cost during cell phase two without the addition of the location technology. We're looking at, as we develop this, our big issue is the amount of time it's going to take us to develop the databases. Right now we have Multnomah County, Marion County, Multnomah, Washington, and Lane County that are capable of doing this today. As soon as they are able to pass that information to us through the system into the PSAP, they're able to map the location of that call based on the GIS information they have now, the GIS systems they developed. But as you get out into the rural counties, they're not capable of doing that. Some of them don't even have GIS capabilities. They're very rudimentary. We're going to have to determine by this trial, we're picking a middle-of-the-road county and see what it's going to take someone that has a little bit of experience with GIS, what it's going to cost to bring a database into compliance where we can use it to actually find somebody. Then there's an ongoing cost of maintenance after that. And hopefully that will allow us to determine the amount of time we're going to need to develop this across the state. Basically, if this technology was available today, we'd have some major population areas up within a month providing the service longer as we went out.
So you seem to have a program or a plan in place. Is it a written plan in terms of how you're going to implement this?
right now, we have a plan in place of what the technologies we want to use. We're not really going to be able to write down an implementation plan until we can see the time limits that we're going to need to do for data conversion. That's a real unknown. Nobody's gone and done this as of yet. And so once we find what an average data conversion is going to do, we'll set up an implementation plan.
Is that, nobody's done that in Oregon, or nobody's done it nationally? Are we leading the pack on these issues, or are we mid-pack, or are we back of the pack from a national perspective?
We're leading in a national perspective. There is a file of this that's been done in the Houston area. That's been done on a very sophisticated GIS system that's already in place. As you get into systems that don't have GIS, we're kind of moving forward rapidly on that because of the fact one of the tenets of our program is we want the same technology that's in Portland available in Kearney County to find people, and that's where it's needed. We've had that ability with the equipment that we've provided, accepted through this program. The same types of technology are available statewide for everybody has the same type. And we use that for the interoperability, the open architecture of the systems, things like that.
So when would you be able to come back and say, here's our plan of action in this biennium and what we think we can accomplish? That isn't a specific, it's going to take me 3 days to do step Y. It's the larger, higher project plan that says, we'll be ready to go forward, July 2nd. We think we've identified who the participating PSAP is going to be, and we've got these carriers who have elected to come forward and participate.
On the trial, we're anticipating starting that April 1st, having that wrapped up hopefully by June of this year, yes, sir. And once we get that information in, there would be a six-month window that we'd have to notify the wireless companies that within 6 months they have to provide this service. And during that time, we would set up the implementation plan for what counties are going to go. And, of course, the ones that are up and ready will go very quickly. And then we would start going farther out with the ones that we're going to have to devote man hours to develop the databases. But we could do that probably in the fall this year.
So from this perspective, have all carriers implemented Phase 1 in the state?
No. We have three carriers that have not implemented Phase 1 as of yet. We have five that are operating and negotiating with the other three.
And so you have officially requested all three carriers?
Yes. We've had various issues on price, non-disclosure agreements, et cetera, that we're working out the details to get them up and running. We have one new carrier that's coming in that's indicated they will start when they start operating with Phase 1 already in place.
Okay. So over the larger project, can we get an estimated cost and project that against estimated wireless 911 revenues? Do you see whether does the program pay for itself? I'm trying to see how much money is coming in over the stream. If you all things remain equal and everyone's going to go implement Phase 2, what's the larger project and what's the total cost going to be to implement this across all regions?
Well, this project we're estimating approximately $4 to $4.5 million. One of the issues we have on that's going to be the main cost of implementation is the man hours. We think that's where our main cost is going to be. The software and hardware will not be the main cost.
And that's over a biennium, over multiple bienniums, over the next 10 years?
That would be probably over this biennium as we start doing the process. We figure after we have that up and running, the maintenance cost of keeping the maintenance fresh could run up to $1 million a year. We're not positive. That's what the trial is going to help show us. Right now, we are currently funded with a $10 million balance in the account that has been collected from wireless people under our guidelines that's to go for Phase 2 to get this project up and running, that we will basically spend that account for this project and the associated issues with it down and basically come up to, we're collecting $10 million a year approximately today in 911 tax funds for the enhanced program. We'll probably be expending between 9.2 and 9.3 a year for all the ongoing costs for enhanced 911.
I guess I'm confused. You just said that it was going to cost you about $4 to $6 million. $4 million. Mm-hmm. This biennium, we got 10, that leaves 6. We're going to collect 10, that leaves 16 at the end. What's the other?
Well, there's still some other, in that $10 million, there's still some other costs for the wireless enhanced 911 program that need to be paid out of that, which will spend that program down. That's finishing up the Portland upgrade to new equipment, those issues. But basically, there's an ongoing cost for the whole program. The state is responsible for the funding of the enhanced 911 program, not only for the implementation, but for the ongoing cost. And we're estimating that when we're done with phase two, that it's going to cost approximately $9.2 million a year for the network costs, maintenance costs, database costs, and CPE replacement costs on a yearly basis for this program.
So, and then are we accruing any savings or excess collections going forward? Or
there could possibly be $400,000 or $500,000 a year that's accruing. We're not going to be able to tell that until we're done.
Okay, I'm amazed that someone was so clairvoyant as to figure out that 75 cents a line per month would be just enough money to operate this system into the future. So,
to be honest with you, we thought we'd be coming back to you at this time for more money based on the information that we had on wireless phase two and the costs that were being bandied about for each cell site costing $30,000. We may have to come back and ask for more money. We've basically been lucky, I guess. We've really tried to plan it out to make sure we don't go without the money. The way the system was set up, we were able to take care of all our ongoing infrastructure costs at the beginning of the program by saving some of the money as we ramped up to start implementing them. There was a balance that was able to pay for those costs, and as we've gotten full network use now, we're spending those funds.
So going into the next biennium, then if there's an ongoing $1 million cost plus whatever the operational costs are, what do we see going into future bienniums as excess collections rolling in once you do the large expenditures?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any projections going forward? I'm just, this is,
I guess,
relevant because we've got if you're going through this legislative body, is the continuation of the excise tax. And so I'm just trying to understand going forward, so we're going to address the problem, we're going to start collecting a whole bunch of money in this fund in the next biennium because there's no reason to be spending it. We spend the largest portions that we need to do now, or are we going to come back and then we'll have some other reasons to spend the dollars out of there?
Chairman Hill, we're looking at the 75 cents that's currently being collected if all our assumptions hold true. And right now that's dealing with about $10 million a year. And part of that is interest on the account that's in the interest on the balance that's in the account today. If that balance goes away or goes down, the interest will be less and we'll probably be collecting about 9.5. Of course, there's going to be some growth in there also. And right now we're estimating our yearly costs are going to be about $9.2 to $9.3 million a year to maintain the system up to the phase two technology. As you all know, technology is changing every day. Now we've just been made aware that Dallas has a program running now where they're going to internet telephony. People are going to dial 911 on that service. How is it going to be handled? Those are issues we may have to come back and ask for a policy decision from this body as to what you want to do. Do you want to, I guess the term is chase technology, but we're going to have to deal with that. So if we end up with a balance, we'll be glad to come back and report that and give you what our take is and what needs to be done.
Maybe a question of a different vein. How many PSAPs are there?
There are 56, sir. Representative.
There are 56 primary?
Primary public safety answering points, yes, sir.
And what about secondary PSAPs?
Representative Patridge, there are 17 of those today, I believe.
Okay.
Secondary PSAPs do not receive money from the state. Do not pay for any services at a secondary PSAP.
Okay. Yep. Can you define what the difference between a primary and a secondary is?
Chairman Hill, Representative Patridge. A primary PSAP actually receives 911 calls directly from the public. Anytime you dial 911, the first person that answers that phone will be at a primary public safety answering point, and they have to meet certain standards, et cetera. A secondary PSAP is how it receives calls that are transferred from a primary, and then they can handle those calls. Or they will not be the first place to answer a call. They have different standards. A secondary PSAP is purely a local decision. It's like they're not funded at all by the 911 tax.
Okay. Can you give me a list of those secondary PSAPs?
I can get that for you. I don't have it with me today.
Here's one of my district.
Okay. Maybe we should let the people testify.
Are you ready for that? Let them test it, I know we can approve this. You have, people from Medford and you're traveling today. Let me invite,
is anyone here to testify?
Are they gonna keep?
Okay. I know there's a lot of 911 people in the back of the room, so.
Nobody wants to talk?
We won't give you the opportunity if you traveled to come and talk today. If not, that's fine, we'll continue on here.
Okay, great.
You scared them.
Senator Yee?
When Mr. Khan provides the secondary information, please give it to the committee administrator so we can all get a copy.
Okay, then, are we going ahead with 911? I got more questions.
Go ahead.
So my question, there were some studies that were done during the interim regarding 911 service statewide, is that correct?
Representative Chairman Pat, Representative Patridge, yes, that's correct.
And I guess of the 56, primary PSAPs that the state supports, was there, is there some, I don't know how to,
Want me to say?
Overage or, is there a waste of money?
Do we have too many PSAPs?
Do we have too many PSAPs?
Chairman Hill, Representative Partridge, based on the way the program's been set up in Oregon with the state mandate, local control, and the ability for each local jurisdiction to look at their situation and decide how much, how many PSAPs they want, I would say no. And I base that on the fact that we've let them look at their local situation and determine the number of PSAPs. Are we wasting money? Or, I mean, I would say no. We distribute the same amount of money to each county, be there one PSAP in the county or four.
Let me ask a question, can we be more efficient, in the utilization of these tax dollars? Can we provide the equivalent level of service by being more efficient?
Chairman Hill, Representative Partridge, I think that local government who provides the service, not only with the 911 section, but also they do with their local dollars, all the dispatch functions, et cetera, that are needed, have determined that this is the way they need it to operate for various reasons. Be it, they want to keep someone on duty in their town, whatever. It's been a local option to do that, and that's how it's proceeded. More efficiency, that's a term that comes in very difficult to determine. As we looked at the study and the consultants looked at it, we brought somebody in that was not involved in this, and determined that is the local option of how they want to do that.
Representative Patridge? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm from Medford. I've worked in the DA's office, so I worked for the county. I was on the Medford City Council. So, Medford has a PSAP, and the county, there's a regional PSAP. They're within a stone's throw of each other, in terms of the buildings they're housed in. The studies that I've seen show that Medford on a cost per call does a much more efficient job than the county PSAP. Does the state take those things into consideration when providing funding and forcing people to come together to consolidate?
Chairman Hill, Representative Patridge, we do not force people to come together and to consolidate. Our mandate was to go to local government and have them come up with a plan for providing 911 services statewide. Local governments looked at what would best serve their areas. When you look at costs for calls, costs for what's going on, there are various other things that come in the PSAP. 911 funding from the state is just dealing with the 911 call-taking aspect of the system. There's a myriad of other things that are involved, dispatch being the primary large user of monies for personnel, et cetera. That comes into effect with what type of radio systems are out there, how these people have done that. As you force, if you want to use that term, these people to consolidate, we could consolidate the 911 function into one operation, but then you're really diluting the effectiveness of 911. Take, for example, state of New Hampshire. They have one PSAP, the state of New Hampshire. They have maybe 10 people sitting there. The phone rings. They pick it up. What's your emergency? The person says, I have a police emergency. Based on the enhanced information, they press a button and send that call to one of 280 dispatch points. And that's how they deal with 911. The person has to then relate their emergency at that dispatch point where the call is dispatched. Some people say that is efficient. Some people say it's not because you're forcing the person to talk to somebody twice. to get a service done. But that's keeping them out of all the ancillary services that here in Oregon a PSAP provides. And they range from the fact that the person in there is doing 911 in a small center, also monitoring the jail, working the counter, doing all these other issues that are a cost to the local government and a service to the public. And they have to justify that expense to their local populace, and apparently they're doing that. We had some consolidations. Measure 5 caused some consolidations. Things have leveled off. There have been people or agencies that are always looking at consolidations, trying to decide what's best for them. But you get into a lot of issues with if we consolidate a PSAP and a dispatch center together, there's a lot of costs involved with that because of differences in radio systems, things like that. So it's always been a local option of how they're going to operate, and that's how we set the system up. And that's how it's operated since 1981. And
but that doesn't that drive the cost of how much the state is going to charge the surtax? Isn't this, I mean, we're being asked as a state legislature this time to reauthorize the per line fee, and by whatever the locals decide they want to do, doesn't that drive the cost of the fee in order to pay for the programs? In my situation, they're obviously paying for, you know, duplicate software, duplicate computer systems, you know, and a lot of those things, duplicate backup, a lot of those issues that are driving the cost that we're being asked to continue this legislative session. And I'm wondering, you know, do we have an obligation as a state to look at some of those things? And do we have an obligation, I guess, to taxpayers to just kind of have a laissez-faire attitude or just to make it happen otherwise?
Chairman Hill, Representative Partiz, I understand your question. We've looked at the situation with what would the state save if, let's say, there was one PSAP per county. Take Medford, your jurisdiction, for example. They chose one PSAP, wherever that may be. The other PSAP equipment, those PSAPs, the equipment that the state buys is sized to population. Okay, there's going to be probably 80% of what's involved now in those other two PSAPs to transfer over to whichever was chosen as the main PSAP to make up for the additional population coming into that place. There would be some minor savings in some equipment. The network charges wouldn't change very much because you're still going to have to size the network to take in all those people. Right now it's sized over 3. We have to size it over 1. We may be able to cut out a couple lines. We have to do a real study of that to see. The cost, though, for moving everything into one PSAP in that area are going to be higher for trying to deal with whatever radio systems are available, what needs to be changed there. If by one PSAP, you mean one PSAP that does not only 911 call answering, but dispatch. It's 911 call answering only, that's a different, and that's what the state pays, for 911 call answering only. So if that is changed now, there's going to be an additional burden on local government, because some of the monies that are passed through to them do help pay for call takers, and those call takers do double duty. When they're not taking 911 call, they're doing something else, taking a non-emergency call from the public, et cetera. And if it all goes over here, they're going to have to make up for that with local dollars. That's some of the thinking that's being done. We've looked at this issue, and yes, there would be some savings. I don't believe it would be very significant. The same monies, because the monies are distributed to them via population for the counties unincorporated, for the cities incorporated, would go to the county whether there's one PSAP or 4. If there's one, then there's more money going to one service. If there's 3, there's not as much, and the local government is making it up. And that's a decision they've made to do that. So I understand your question, and I would say there would probably be some savings, but I don't think it would be a very significant amount.
It could be significant to
it could be
a single program in terms of in which could overall provide better service to the region it serves, rather than distributing those dollars out to multiple small, so you're getting the biggest use of those dollars.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hazard a guess as to which is the best way to go for public service? A local community might have a local flavor, a sense of a more of a strong sensibility about what an appropriate response might be to a given situation. Say you have somebody who's simply lonely and there are multiple calls and so not emergency nature, really. But I'm rambling.
Can I save Ken from having to answer that question?
Yeah.
Because it serves Both.
You serve both?
Yes, sir. So it probably wouldn't be a good...
No, actually, it was a softball. I was going to let him say, I was going to let him say they both have their uses.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. I want me to ask, Chairman Hill, Representative Lowe, I would support the consultant's report, and it's a local decision. I think the information, the way this program has been set up, how we've marched down this road for 21 years, has proven to work. We have a fine system, and matter of fact, we have one of the leading systems in the country. And the very needs that you've talked about on a local level are water keeping those PSAPs out there, and they have proved...
I guess what I'm really...
We have somebody willing to answer the question.
Thank you. May I redefine my question just a little bit more sharply, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you may.
I want to know if there have been a lot of complaints.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, for the record, my name is Michelle Deister. I'm with the League of Oregon Cities. In general, your question, have there been a lot of complaints with regard to municipal call centers? Is that your question? Or local versus regional? I would respond to that by saying that all 911 call centers are required to meet certain standards that are set by the Office of Emergency Management. If they do not meet those standards, they are not eligible to receive 911 tax dollars. Therefore, there is a minimum level of competency that is set, and I believe that many municipalities would indeed argue that their service levels are actually higher than some of the call centers in surrounding areas.
I'm motivated to ask that question, Mr. Chair, because there's a local one in where I live.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. I actually, could maybe speak to this a little more broadly if that's the pleasure of the committee.
Certainly.
Okay. As you know, there was a multi-PSAP evaluation study done and completed in October of 2000, which spoke directly to the issue of consolidating communication centers. The study recommended that the state should regard the consolidation of communication centers as an issue for local determination.
Can I interrupt you there? What was the question that was that generated the need for the report?
Representative Hill, back in 1995, the legislature was dealing with the remnants of another study that was done in 93-94 on the number of PSAPs within the state, and basically took no action at that time and wanted to come back in this legislative session with another report and recommendation on the situation of multi-PSAP.
So the question was?
Statute derived them to do that one study, and then a budget note directed them to do a second study.
So what was the question?
Representative Hill, I can read that for you if you'd like.
Sure.
Prior to December 31st, 2000, any 911 jurisdiction that operates a primary public safety answering point in a county in which more than one primary public safety answering point is located shall demonstrate the benefits of having multiple primary public safety answering points in the county. The benefits shall be defined as providing better service or cost savings that has been verified. The demonstration shall result in a written report to OEM.
So how does that request translate into a recommendation that it be left up to local control? I'm just curious.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think there are a lot of issues with regard to consolidating 911 call centers. First of all, it speaks to questions of better service. I think it depends on how you define better service. I think certain communities would define that in different ways. Secondly, are there efficiencies to be gained? Well, I guess that depends upon your point of view. Consolidation of multiple PSAPs would, in many circumstances, require the development of a new facility that is large enough to host a consolidated PSAP, and the cost of constructing a new facility would likely obliterate any administrative cost savings that could be realized from consolidation.
Is that in a single biennium or is it within the long term?
I guess the report specifically mentions the fact that most call centers have studied or attempted consolidation in the past, and in fact a high level of consolidation has already been achieved over the years. We've gone from 239 primary public safety answering points down to 56. And basically even the study states that the remaining candidates for consolidation are now mostly small agencies presenting limited opportunities for cost savings or service improvements. Therefore, you need to ask yourself, is the squeeze really worth the juice, if you will?
President Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the October 2000 report.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is the report confirms that 14 of 36 counties have multiple PSAPs, and that 8 counties have 2 PSAPs, 4 counties have 4 PSAPs, and 2 had 3 PSAPs. Would you disagree with the conclusion from the report? The consultant concluded that 1 PSAP per county achieves the maximum practical benefit of consolidation, while at the same time preserving local control at the county level.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, I have also read the report, and then my interpretation of it was that that may be the case in some areas, but it certainly varies on a region-by-region basis.
But would you agree that that is the conclusion of the report, that while it should be left up, while it is a local, that I think the report left it, I don't think the report came to a final conclusion because of the political nature of what of the question that was answered. But I believe that the reports came to the conclusion that 1 PSAP per county is sufficient and provides enough autonomy and local control. Would you disagree with my reading of the report?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, again, that wasn't the conclusion that I necessarily reached.
Let me ask the question this way. If you work for the Association of Oregon Counties, would you answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, I'm very happy that I don't work for the Association of Oregon Counties, and so, therefore, I cannot speak to that issue.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think it would be helpful to have the 911 report. I think Mr. Nisswender has spent a substantial amount of time with that report, and... You know, I think that we should maybe explore this a little bit.
I have a copy from the Government Efficiency Committee, and we can get other copies distributed out so everybody's understanding what we're talking about. Let's jump to a different subject. We'll come back to that issue. Right now, under law, you can take up to 4% of the tax revenues for administrative costs. You're taking 3% right now. That's about 1.6, if I'm understanding about. It's about $56 million total being collected off of return.
Approximately $50 million, I think, is anticipated for 0103 total revenue.
So it's about $1.something million. What are we buying with $1.something million at the state level?
Representative Hill, we're buying a staff of 5 people that administer this program, do the work of paying the bills, et cetera, for the 911 system.
So are you doing development at the state level, or when you go and you do a pilot project, you're going to go and find a willing PSAP to work with you, and you're going to do a pilot down there?
That is correct. We're going to do a pilot at a county with their personnel, and we have a person who is involved in the GIS business that will help work that situation out and do the testing, et cetera.
Another question, sort of, you may not be the right person to ask, but I'm going to ask the question. I'm seeking an answer. Department of Revenue is keeping up to 1%, which is about $500,000. If I did my math correctly, is that a correct number? 500,000?
1% of 500,000.
Okay. Why is it taking $500,000 to collect from telephone companies collections? You're probably not the right person. That's a question I'm asking. Of why we're spending 1% of these dollars over at the Department of Revenue to collect from, you know, I guess there's 36 local telephone companies or however many we've got more, the CLECs.
Representative Hill, I am the right person because we can pay that bill to them, and they aren't taking the full 1%. That was just what was written into the law. They're allowed to do that.
How much are they keeping?
They're probably keeping about $22,000 a quarter.
Okay, so
for expenses, they're not getting 5%.
Okay, the way your thing was written here is
we were just trying to break it down as to what everybody was allowed to take.
Okay, I'm just like, that's an awful lot of money to be collecting.
Correct.
From a small.
And you have to realize that was written back at the 1% level when we were only collecting $1 million of a year, or $2 or $3 million a year the first 81-82.
Representative Patridge.
Thank you, Representative. Hey, I was wondering. You said that Multnomah County and Lane County, basically, or that geographic area covered, by one or whatever, however many PSAPs are there. They're the ones that have E-911 service.
Representative Hill, Representative Partridge, the entire state of Oregon has E-911 service. We're border to border, have been that way since.
But what services do Multnomah and Lane County have that the other PSAPs don't have?
Chairman Hill, Representative Partridge, they have GIS capabilities that are well beyond everybody else. So they already have a GIS map that they can match their, what they call their MSAG, into a GIS format. So they can already provide, if we send them a Latin long, they can already plot that Latin long on their CAD period dispatch system.
And why don't other areas of the state have that?
Chairman Hill, Representative Patrick, it's an expensive system. And that's a local option of what they want to buy. It's not a requirement of our program. It's becoming a requirement. And as it becomes a requirement, we are going to, for the limited purpose of 911, provide them with a GIS geographic map database. They will be able to take advantage of that if they want to for other things, but we will provide that. We do provide the database maintenance to Multnomah County and Lane County to help them develop that. And basically, they just cut out the step of going from a tabular database into the GIS because they have a significant investment in GIS within those counties.
Are they using the E-911 dollars to develop that, or is it coming from the local dollars to pay for that?
Representative, that comes from our local dollars. We will help, once they have that system up, we help them maintain. When a new address comes in that needs to be added to the database, so it gets into the database that we use, then we will help provide that. And that's running us. In Multnomah County, you're probably paying less than $200 a month for them to maintain that. It's a pretty good bargain.
So with the local, so the locals are paying for it, not out of state dollars that they're receiving. They're only paying for it out of, they're paying it for it out of local dollars and not paying for it out of any state dollars in Multnomah and Lane County.
Representative Hill, Representative Patrick, at this time, yes. Any GIS that's out there has been paid for by local dollars, not by 911 funds.
But what about the software and technology that filters through the 911 system? Is that being paid for through state 911 dollars?
Chairman Hill, Representative Patrick, right now we have not provided any GIS equipment to those locations. The 911 telephone equipment, yes, it's paid for in each jurisdiction by the state. The actual 911 telephone answering equipment.
So just to clarify then, the only thing that is prohibiting those other areas from doing the geographically locating 911 calls is the fact that local jurisdictions haven't invested the money to do the GIS mapping and maintain a database? Is that what you're telling me?
Representative Hill, they have not had that investment in GIS equipment in a lot of places in the state. The larger counties have some sort of GIS. And most of your counties that have some population up and down the western portion of the state have some capability of GIS, but not to the extent that Multnomah County, Lane County have. They have very extensive GIS programs through Metro up in the Washington area, or Portland, Washington County, Clackamas County here. And Lane County is very sophisticated with their GIS programs. They've chosen to do.
Okay, very briefly, can you tell us how you're working with the geospatial, BAS, geospatial, whatever that new group is, and that how we are going to, when we spend these dollars, we'll be using data sets that pre-exist as much as possible without having to create new data sets, and how it would be very efficient in this state in how we implement GIS to all of these concepts.
Mr. Chair, we're already meeting with DAS. I mean, this is just a pilot. We can tell you we're just getting started. We had a meeting with the state's GIS coordinator and the IRMD analyst that is assigned to state police just within the last couple of weeks, I believe it was. And so, I mean, I don't want to say we're joined at the hip yet, but we're clearly trying to communicate what it is we're trying to do, allow them to see what it is, and insofar as they can bring some resources to the table that already exist within the Department of Administrative Services and the state's digital map library, we have no desire to pay for that again or recreate it, because that's hard stuff to do and pretty tough to maintain. So anything we can do to leverage what has already been done, I can assure you we're going to be doing that.
Thanks. Chairman Hill, we are working very closely with these folks to make sure that what we're doing meets the right guidelines, et cetera. And we've always had the function in our program that there's something we can do that local government can leverage off of, you know, that's good too.
Excellent. Very good. Let's jump off of 911. Let's continue on here. We'll come back to 911. We'll address the issues. We just wanted to touch on it. We'll give an opportunity for those who can come and testify. So let's continue on.
Mr. Chair, where we left off, which was on question one, we're talking about our policy option packages. The primary one that we covered was the public safety data warehouse and gave you an overview of that. If you go back to these pages in your handout, which follow right behind the page that says attachment, there's a bunch of pages that look just like this. What I'd like to do is try to briefly walk you through some of the base budget IT projects that we are going to be embarking upon in the coming biennium, so you have a familiarity with that. And since the first two base budget projects that are in there, again, what you're doing is you're looking for a page that looks like this. At the top, it'll say NCIC 2000 update will be the page that you're looking for. What I'd like to do is to have David Yandell, our LEDS director, talk about NCIC 2000. Again, this falls under the law enforcement data systems, and have him also give you a quick overview on the LEDS message switch replacement. So those two pages, and then I'll touch on the rest of them.
Chair Hill, again, for the record, David Yandell, director of the Law Enforcement Data System Division. The NCIC 2000 update project is one that comes about as a result of the FBI's implementation of their new system, NCIC 2000, which was implemented July the 11th of 1999. That project is a nationwide effort that came as a result of about 10 to 15 years of effort on the FBI's part to upgrade their aging system and to also meet the Y2K concerns that the FBI had with their system prior to January the 1st of 2000. Their system, when they turned it up in July of 99, allowed each of the states 3 full years to complete any programming work required to take full advantage of NCIC 2000 capabilities. We are in the very final stage of entering into a sole source contract with a contractor to begin work. Hopefully right after the first part of March, with anticipated completion on or about June the 1st of next year to coincide with the July 11th of 2002 deadline for having NCIC 2000 in place. That capability will provide law enforcement throughout the state with the ability to access features that currently are unavailable. One of the options that we'll be addressing as part of this project to at least set the stage for deliberating how we go about addressing it is the potential of being able to pass images, mugshots, fingerprint files, and other image-based documents through the system, which is currently a capability that we do not have. But that project, very briefly, is what NCIC 2000 consists of. Any questions on that project?
David, you may want to just mention the funding.
Yes, the Representative Hill, the members of the committee, the funding source for this is a what's referred to as a National Criminal History Improvement Grant, specifically was attained for purposes of funding this project. So this is a fully federally funded project, which we anticipate being able to accomplish within that amount allocated. Okay. The next project is the...
I have a question. I think it's great that you're complying with the federal standards, and I assume those are data and technology standards. Is that correct?
Chair Hill, Representative Patridge, that is the primary focal point, yes, but there are some functions, new functionality that will be offered to law enforcement throughout the state, throughout the country, for that matter, under that initiative.
But what about the data integrity and data entry portions of that?
Chair Hill, Representative Patridge, the whole process of data entry is one that we're actually working to coordinate through the CGIS board process here in the state. The actual process of NCIC 2000 simply is a an upgrade of the existing system and the provision of additional capability through the NCIC 2000 initiative.
Well, let me just kind of say where I'm going. Isn't it true that we've done some background checks on people who've asked for concealed weapons permits, and those permits have been issued when those people are, in fact, convicted felons, and the data has not been properly entered into the LED system or properly aligned in the LED system to catch those people?
Chair Hill, Representative Patridge, I believe the issue that I certainly sense your frustration with is one that we are working to try to address through the CJIS process. That is the purpose of that standards board, to bring all of the criminal justice information practitioners to the table to work on issues that are cross-discipline. And that issue is truly a cross-discipline issue and one that we are working to address.
So,
but just as a follow-up, but that still doesn't answer my question about whether we're not having the data in the LED system that is supposed to be there when we have convicted felons getting concealed weapons permits when they're checked on the LED system.
Chair Hill, Representative Patridge, it is true that we do have instances where there is information that's currently being located or stored at the local level that has not been entered into LEDs. LEDs was established back in 1969, as you well know, as the focal point for the collection of statewide information. And if it don't get input to that repository, the issue that I believe you're concerned about is of mutual concern.
Who sets the standards in terms of requirements for entering the data into LED? In terms of, is that something that comes from the state police from establishing administrative rules in terms of, so that, you know, something happens out here, someone is responsible for inputting that information into LED in a timely manner?
Chair Hill, there are several different focal points for policy. We certainly at LEDs are required to adhere to FBI policy regarding the entry of information. LEDs has administrative rules in place and rules and regulations and policy in the LEDs manual that all of the local agencies are required to enter into the system. And that information is checked. We have an ongoing quality assurance program in which we go out and actually monitor the input of the information into the system.
So, but just these packages are not going to address those issues. Those are administrative issues in terms of if at an agency is sitting in a pile and the person who is responsible for typing the LEDs is sick for a week, it's not getting in. I mean, that's where I'm sort of driving to, is that these hardware don't address the issues that may be a result of what Representative Patrick is talking about, which is the lack of structure in the database. And the
Mr. Chair, that's correct for those projects. You know, we're getting in the back of these list of projects. You'll find one we'll get to. I'll just jump to it right now because I think it begins to address some of your questions and concerns. There's one in back called Refresh Criminal Records Improvement Plan. This deals with an audit of our computerized criminal history file, which is the last audit that was done on CCH was in 1994. And David, you may be able to give a little bit more detail. The audit did find some, flaws in our computerized criminal history file, and they were notable. However, as compared with the other 50 states, we were out in front as far as the reliability of the information that was in our system. And so it was kind of a bittersweet finding. We have not done another one of those audits since 1994, and we plan early in the 0103 biennium using some federal grant dollars to do yet another audit, which will help us, I think, get at some of the, I don't want to call it hearsay, but you hear people say, well, you know, this information isn't there, so we're going to try to actually do a formal look at the accuracy of the information in our CCH file and then make the necessary adjustments to try to bring the level up. Again, I don't know if that gets at all of the questions that you have on this, but.
Well, my question is, we're upgrading our LEDs system. We're upgrading it to meet some NCIC standards, which are the federal standards, as a result of this package. What are we doing to make sure that our system is upgraded when we're upgrading at the same time and we're changing the system around to make sure that we have better data integrity and better entry, whether that be opening the system up or pulling data either from the court systems, from local DEA systems, or any of those kinds of things. What are we doing to do that? I think part of MCIC's standards are to maintain a high level of data integrity.
Chair Hill, Representative Patridge, I believe the comments that the chair shared about these particular projects, these are projects that are specifically aimed at providing specific modifications to existing systems to bring them up to new specification. The issues that I believe you're speaking to, and I'm sure you'll correct me if I don't have it right, I believe gets to a matter of policy of how the criminal justice community in the state of Oregon enters criminal justice information in a coordinated fashion and gets where it needs to go. And that really is the process of the Criminal Justice Information Standards Board, and that is an issue that we are beginning to spend some time discussing, recognizing that we do need to take a hard look at that.
This begs the question, in terms of, we had a lot of discussion in terms of the last election with Measure 5 and criminal background checks. It sort of begs the question in terms of, there's a perception of in the public in terms of that we've got good data integrity. If we don't have good data integrity in the data secret, if we don't have it, it doesn't matter if we require criminal background checks at a gun show, because you can still quite possibly be a felon and still pass that criminal background check and be authorized to purchase a handgun. So in terms of, so I guess it begs the question, so we're looking at this, there's 99,000, there's 100,000, and this is paying for an audit? Is that on the Refresh Criminal Records Improvement Plan?
That's correct. Basically, last time we did this, we brought in an outside consultant who had some expertise in doing this, and it was an independent study, and they went around to the various users, looked at the system, and tried to match that up with what was out in some of the local systems, and then develop the report. This is, again, a bit of a bug number based on what we had to spend before for this audit.
When was the last time, because I'm not familiar enough in terms of the rules related to inputting the data, in terms of, we've got a distributed system today, you don't have a central system everybody's computing all the data to, so it would then be easy to get into the right databases. Have we gone back and looked and reviewed administrative rules in terms of that exist on data, or, you know, gone back and looked at existing statutes and the requirements, you know, for time frame for when something is adjudicated and, you know, that it needs to be implemented and placed into LEDs? Have we looked at the systematic issues contribute to what this problem is that what this $100,000 is going to try to...
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We haven't done that since 1994, is I guess what I'm trying to say. And I think that's going to be a piece of it. I'm operating a little bit at a disadvantage. I wasn't here then, so I don't know exactly what was done, although I've seen copies of the report.
The questions I gave you previously, if I can just run down the questions and we'll get them on the record. Since the implementation of Measure 5, has there been an increase in the number of background checks you conduct?
Mr. Chair, the answer to that is yes.
By approximately how many?
Prior to Measure 5, and I do have a handout for it if you'd like.
Yeah, sure.
Again, Mr. Chair, prior to Measure 5, with only the handguns, which is all that were required to be checked, we averaged about 3,800 a month. After Measure 5, which included all firearms, and that went into effect on the 8th of December of last year, December 2000, it should be, not 2001, which is a high-volume month for firearm transactions. We had 11,752, and that went down to about 8,500.
Representative Patridge?
What's the split, though? I mean,
Measure 5 required long gun checks as well as handguns.
That's correct.
Previously, most of the long guns were done through, at least by dealers, were done federally for free. But now the state charges for them. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, that is correct under Measure 5.
Do you know, can you tell me, based on the data, what the split is between handguns and long guns?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, we have someone from our firearms check who oversees that whole program here today, and I think she could probably answer that.
Chair Hill, I have a really bad cold. I'll try to speak right into this. Chair Hill and Representative Patridge, Claudia Scott, I'm the firearms unit manager that oversees the program of the instant checks. And if I heard your question right, you wanted to know what the split was between long gun and handgun. And we are unable to track an absolute split on a daily basis or a monthly basis because some purchasers buy both, and we are processing and checking the background of the person. And then we run the stolen gun checks on all firearms. So you would have to look at the national instant check versus the state handguns to see the ratio. And in January alone of the last 3 years, our average was right at 4,000 for the month of January. And this January, we did 8,500. So you can see what the ratio would be. I'm anticipating that that will continue for the year.
But I think the nature of this question, why we're trying to ask the question, I guess, and it's important to me to know what the split is so we can really tell, you know, because you have a shift, and you're shifting from most of the guns that were being bought, long guns being bought that were checked on the federal records side and for free, because that's how dealers chose to do it, and it was cheaper for the consumer. Now we've shifted those, and now we're requiring that all the checks be done through the state. And so consequently, you know, we have 8,500 in the month of January 2001, but does that just reflect that the long guns have come over, or are we seeing actually an increase as a result of Measure 5? I mean, I know you can only hypothesize about that because you don't have that information. But I mean, have you talked to the feds to ask them how many checks they were doing a month in Oregon, and then how that works?
Chair Hill, Representative Patridge, whenever I work for the fiscal impact to try to figure out how to change my unit over, I did get a study, and they showed me month by month the amount of months that they could retain my information, which is 180 days. So they gave me those amount of months to give me the long guns that were conducted by dealers. And I used that to figure out my ratio of sales. And it seems to be a little higher in actual sales now than what my ratio indicated whenever I did it from the national. But we do have statistics showing that in the month of January, there were only 53 private sales, so these were all long gun and handguns coming through. Majority is coming through the FFL dealer.
So I guess that
so what?
So my question is, do you think that there are more guns being bought after Measure 5 or not? That's kind of the question we're trying to ask.
Chair, Representative Patridge, I believe that there is an increase this month of January 2001 higher than I anticipated from just looking at the statistics.
Okay.
So I believe there has been more gold.
That's all we can ask you for.
Okay. Let me just run through this again on the record. Is your system able to handle the increased workload?
Chair Hill, yes.
Has your system failed to perform during periods when a gun show was in progress?
Chair Hill, no. Our system, the state system, has never failed.
And then you've got detailed information regarding the federal system being down, specific Are you tracking these things through your system as well?
Yes, we do track it.
Has the increased volume lowered the cost of conducting checks?
Chair Hill, yes. We lowered the cost starting on December 1st to $9 in anticipation of a lower cost. We'll be doing another study when we have 6 months of data to indicate and show the recovery of our startup costs. And then we believe that there's a chance it may go down, but we want to make sure that we get the facts in before we make a determination.
So it was $1, and then you're anticipating afterwards you will pass on any savings after the 6 months time period.
Yes, Chair Hill, yes, we will.
Thank you. Colleagues, let's finish up LED here. So we've got, we're changing the database, and then we're going to go off of BiSync modems, national PFG network. Are we paying for the network, or are local jurisdictions paying for the connection into the LED system?
Chair Hill, local jurisdictions are paying for their connection to LEDs.
These are just dial-up BiSync connections, or I'm just trying to figure out if it's BiSync.
Chair Hill, we have approximately 180 dedicated terminals that we are in the process of phasing out. They are BiSync. The national standard is TCP/IP under NCIC 2000. That kind of brings us to the LEDS message switch project. The LEDS message switch is probably one of the most critical components in the LEDS system. It is, if you will, the hub for connecting all of our various databases together and providing the capability for local law enforcement agencies to acquire information from DMV, from the LEDS files, from NCIC, from other states. It is if you think of it as a LEDS as a wagon wheel, the message switch is the hub through which all that traffic flows. We currently process just under 15 million transactions a month on the network. The current technology is about 10 years old. It is not capable of supporting native TCP/IP. It's an IBM System 88, which is now currently owned by Stratus. They do not manufacture it any longer. We are at a point in time where, coinciding with the NCIC 2000 upgrade, in order to meet full specifications and be capable of providing new services in the future, the message switch is needing replacement. That is a funded project, a federally funded project. We are in the process of developing the mandatories and desirables for an RFP that we intend to have out within the next couple of months.
You replace this with a Stratus computer?
Chair Hill, I'm sorry?
You said it was Stratus, turning on Stratus?
The existing machine is a Stratus, yes, sir.
So are you moving to another fault tolerant machine, or...?
That is the intent, but again, that is part of the process of developing the detailed analysis of the needs for the new architecture.
Well, I'm looking at the cost of the associate, is it not?
Yes, sir. Chair Hill, the total project is estimated right now at about somewhere between $2 and $3 million, and we have $2 million for the actual project and $321,000 for the RFP development.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
So I was looking on the front page and it's back there. Okay. So, and then what is the ripple effect in terms of making this change? Since jurisdictions are going to have to upgrade their equipment as well, do we have an estimated total cost we're going to push down the system here out to all the jurisdictions? Upgrade to be able to link into this?
Chair Hill, that is actually part of the NCIC 2000 project, would be the evaluation of local requirements. They are aware that we're moving in that direction. They, in many instances, are very supportive of our need to move that way because they are, in many instances, moving to TCP/IP as their local standard, and we're having to do a protocol conversion in order to even be able to support them.
So, I'm just trying to see, so are we going to actually do the upgrade in this biennium, or is this just study preceding actual implementation?
Chair Hill, our intent is to complete it in this coming biennium, 0103.
Okay. Representative Patridge.
Thank you, Chair Hill. I guess this is my concern that I started off with about upgrading systems and doing things with LEDs and other things. My interest is in the data integrity of the system as well as I think some savings long term. Is this system going to be adequate enough to be able to link the courts in so that you're actually cross-populating the in real time the LED system with the court convictions?
Sure,
sure. And with the arrests from local police departments. I understand the local police departments are hand-entering arrests for the most part into the LED system, but my concern is, are we cross-populating with the court system, especially just on basic things like convictions?
Chair Hill, Representative Patridge, our intent will be to promote maximum flexibility and to be capable of interfacing with all of the criminal justice partners.
So we don't really have an integrated plan. We don't have a picture yet.
Chair Hill, I guess I'm not exactly sure what you're looking for with
an integrated system in terms of so that you can start updating things from data already being entered in the courts, data being entered in the DA's offices, and it all just sort of flows together and is there.
Chair Hill, I believe, and members of the committee, I believe that capability is in place today. It's a policy issue and how we go about ensuring that we're coordinating, what needs to happen. It's not having the capability of doing what I think I hear you're concerned about. I think that capability is there.
It's just a matter of actually doing it.
Yes, sir. And that's an issue that we're encouraging anyone with examples to illustrate the concern, because we do hear a lot about the very issues you've just raised, but we've asked for examples. We'd like to see where there are pitfalls that we need to address, and we're certainly willing to scrutinize the existing system and to make the necessary and appropriate adjustments.
Representative Patridge.
Well, my question is, if we have federal dollars coming in to pay for the switch, help pay for the switch replacement, I don't know if it's a match or if it's just straight up federal dollars, are we buying the capacity we need in order to put together some kind of integrated enterprise kind of solution we can cross-populate? Or are we going to come down the path and look at this and say, well, geez, we only bought it to hook up our existing user community, and we didn't buy enough capacity on our switch, or we didn't buy enough technology, or this is the wrong technology to cross-populate with the court system, or to cross-populate with the correction system, or to cross-populate with, I don't know if you're keeping sex offender notification on LEDs or you got it on a separate database or how that all works. All those things are critical to the cop on the street doing their day-to-day job. And what I'm asking is, when we're making $2.3 million purchases and more as part of your package, are we really buying what we need, I guess is what I'm asking.
Chair Hill, Representative Patridge, I don't intend this to sound flippant, but once we get through the needs analysis phase, I mean, the intent is to make sure that the investment that we make is a long-term investment, and for the purposes of this particular piece of equipment, 10 years is what we consider to be the range that we're looking at. That means that we would want to take into account all of the initiatives, all of the technological advances that we anticipate by learning from other states, by talking to NCIC, the FBI, NLETS, the National Law Enforcement Telecommunications System folks. They are also in the process of upgrading their system, because we view Oregon as being an integral part of a nationwide network. And what we do here, we need to do with the thought in mind of being able to make that information available to all criminal justice within the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, if I might, I think that as we have an opportunity to maybe describe some of the things that are going on with the CJIS technology plan, again, I'm not sure it's going to address all of the things, but I think it certainly moves us in the right direction in a significant way. There's some other projects that we've got further down here in the packet that I think, again, begin to address that. But at the same time, I don't want to signal that when the NCIC 2000, or when the message switch upgrade is completed, we're going to have, you know, the master system that's going to handle everything. But I think we're going to find that it is going to be a component of the architecture that we need to talk about to link this stuff together.
How do we get information today? I mean, we know this is going to have a ripple effect. How do we calculate in terms of the cost and impact's going to be at the local jurisdictions? And then the impact within the state, so in terms of the elements that we pay for that have connected to lead, what's the impact of that going to be? I start looking at things like, how's that network going to be designed, to support that? Is it of such a nature, obviously, that you don't want it commingled with other data, so it's got to be its own separate secure network? So those are the things that I'm just sort of looking at. What is the ripple cost of making this change from, these old bi-sync to TCP/IP, because suddenly everybody's going to go, I need more than a 56K connection. In fact, that's faster than HTTP faster than what they have today, but everybody's going to want, 256K connection, and suddenly our cost on the telecom side is going to rise. It's not associated with this package. And I'm just...
Chair Hill, that is part of the analysis phase that we'll be moving into first step.
I think it's part of the budget phase, because it's going to be now that we're going to have to address this. Otherwise, somebody's going to come back and ask for more money, because some of them are going to realize that, wait a second, we got to pay for, a bunch of frame circuits to connect up a bunch of terminals in all these disparate places, which, we've been dealing with, cheaper circuits with the bi-sync modems, And then some other, I don't know what other, in varying other agencies are connected to lead that the state pays for, have they built that into their budgets, the fact that they're going to have to get new equipment to support this change, whether that be mid-biennium, end-biennium, plus the transitional costs associated with it. So that's why I'm, this is a discrete project, and I'm looking at how does this ripple out, and then we're going to have local jurisdictions in here going, oh, wait a minute, we knew it was coming, though, but hey, suddenly it's going to be more expensive for me.
Chair Hill, I would ask that you give us a bit of time to respond to your question. I understand what you're...
How about Monday?
We'll do our best to have an answer for you Monday. We have, just so you know, we have 34 regional systems in the state of Oregon through which a vast majority of our 9,000-some-odd devices receive lead services through. And we recognize that one of our challenges will be to work with all of those regional agencies to ensure that we coordinate that process in such a way that it minimizes financial impact and that we don't...
How many localities? So you got 34 and 9,000 devices. How many in separate localities? So in other words, how many circuits are going to be showing up at the state to connect into this lead? So,
I'm not prepared to give that to you off the top of my head, but again, we'll get you the answer to those questions.
Okay. With that, we have gone over. Thanks for the indulgence of the committee members. We'll be back Monday with this, and then we need to power through this on Monday, make our recommendations, and move on to. I think we're also going to try to do Board of Nursing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. We also need to do Board of Nursing on Monday, so we have limited time on Monday. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing, and without objection.